Innovation Alberta, a celebration of science, research, and the inventive spirit. I'm Cheryl Croucher. Carbohydrates and proteins have been making big news on the diet scene of late. But the carbohydrates and proteins that David Bundle, Todd Lowry, and John Klassen are investigating have nothing to do with the food we eat. As researchers with the Alberta Ingenuity Centre for Carbohydrate Science, they're studying how carbohydrate and protein molecules interact so they can develop new treatments for diseases like E. coli, Alzheimer's, and tuberculosis. These stories coming up in the next half hour on Innovation Alberta. The Alberta Ingenuity Centre for Carbohydrate Science was established in Edmonton in the fall of 2002. Since that time, the seven principal investigators working from the University of Alberta and the University of Calgary have been busy looking at how carbohydrates bind with proteins. Their collaborative insights will eventually help us synthesize these processes to prevent or treat disease. Dr. David Bundle is the scientific director of the Alberta Ingenuity Centre for Carbohydrate Science. Next week, he travels to San Diego, and there he'll receive the Claude S. Hudson Award in Carbohydrate Chemistry, and that's for some of his pioneering work. And this week, he was honoured by the University of Alberta with the J. Gordon Kaplan Award for Research Excellence.
Well, it's very gratifying. It's sort of these things sometimes come in waves. Not that I've received so many, but last year I had three awards, so it was rather overwhelming, actually. So it's very pleasant.
Your area is in carbohydrate research. What is the significance of carbohydrates to what we're doing in terms of health and health research?
Well, most people think of carbohydrates from a dietary point of view, but in fact, our cells and the cells of microorganisms such as bacteria and fungi very often have copious amounts of carbohydrate on their cell surfaces. So actually, when the cells are interacting with the environment or, say, an invading organism encounters our immune system, it's the carbohydrates on the exterior of cells that are first being recognized. So our interest is to see whether we can better understand this process and also to use this in fighting diseases. I should also say that nearly every protein in our body is glycosylated, so that means it carries carbohydrates, and those carbohydrates perform very often an essential function, and so this is another area that we're interested in.
With your research, you're hitting on a lot of the hot topics for people, E. coli, cancer, Candida albicans, Alzheimer's. Where do you start?
Well, maybe I should just start with the E. coli toxin that was produced by bacterium Escherichia coli. And this was the organism that caused several deaths in Walkerton, Ontario, when water was contaminated. This toxin is produced by the bacteria in cattle, and it can find its way into our meat supply, mainly through ground hamburger that's undercooked. But also cattle shed the E. coli and the toxin in feces, and it can also find its way into groundwater, which was what happened in Walkerton. Now, this toxin binds carbohydrate that are on our cell surfaces. And in fact, young children have an abundance of this particular carbohydrate, which is called a PK trisaccharide. It's a human blood group determinant. And children have a large amount of this on their kidney. And this is why young children are often very susceptible to the E. coli infection. Now, it's a generally observed fact that when sugars bind to the proteins that recognize them, they do so with rather weak binding, so that one would have to use a very large amount of a natural compound to inhibit this binding. Now, the E. coli toxin binds to carbohydrates on our cell surface, and then it enters the cell after this initial binding event. So if we could inhibit the toxin from binding to the cell surface, then we would be able to stop the toxin gaining entry to the cell and it would be harmless. However, to do this, we'd have to have a small molecular weight compound which had very tight binding to the toxin. And so far, the paradigm for sugar binding to their receptors is that it's always weak binding. So this would just be impossible without some significant advance. So we've been studying this for a number of years, and then a postdoctoral fellow in my group, Pavel Kitov, came up with the idea that what we should do is to design a molecule that acts very much like the carbohydrates on our cell surface. So what I should tell you in relation to this is that the toxin is a donut-shaped molecule, and on its surface it has five binding sites around the donut ring that bind very tightly to the carbohydrate. It has some others, too, which bind to the carbohydrate much more weakly, but these five binding sites are the principal ones. Now, because our cell surface has carbohydrates all over the surface, this donut-shaped molecule can come down on the cell surface and it can engage all five binding sites at one time with five different copies of our PK trisaccharide that is on the cell surface. So in order to get those two apart, it's like trying to pull Velcro apart. It's very difficult to do. But Pavel's idea was that, well, if we made an inhibitor which had multiple copies of this PK trisaccharide correctly spaced so that it fit these five binding sites on this donut-shaped molecule, then we could inhibit the binding to the cell surface. And the way he did this was to take a glucose molecule, which allows us to attach five molecular spokes to it. So if you can imagine, this glucose molecule sits at the middle in the center, and there are five spokes radiate out rather like a starfish. And then at the end of these spokes, we put two copies of this PK trisaccharide.
How hard is it to actually come up with a synthetic molecule like that?
Yeah, it's quite tough. And, of course, this is one of the reasons why it would be difficult to reduce this to a practical application, because making a molecule like this is expensive, and also making it in large amounts would be difficult. But nevertheless, it establishes a proof of concept. So what he did, he made this molecule, and this molecule was a million times more active than the single PK trisaccharide binding to the toxin. So what actually happened was that if you imagine these donut-shaped toxin molecule with five binding sites, this starfish molecule has five spokes, and at the end of it you have two copies of the sugar. So five of those 10 copies bind to one toxin molecule, and the other five bind to a second toxin molecule. So what you have is something a bit like a molecular sandwich. You have toxin molecule, you have starfish in between the first toxin molecule and the second molecule, and they come together rather like hamburger buns sandwiching a hamburger patty. And, of course, when the toxin molecule has done that, it's no longer available to bind to cell surfaces. And, in fact, with Dr. Glenn Armstrong, who used to be at the U of A and is now at the University of Calgary, we showed that when we administered this starfish molecule in mice and infected them with the toxin, we could protect up to 60% of the mice that would otherwise have died. So the molecule does work. It's just rather difficult to conceive of using in humans. Although we now have another possible way to deal with toxin molecule that we're working on at the moment, which evolved from this original approach, but somewhat difficult. But generally using the same kind of design principles.
This came out of work on E. coli, but does it have any other applications?
Well, yes. You see, we obtain crystal structures of the protein with the carbohydrate, and this allows us to see the general binding motif. Now, it turns out that there's another molecule in the human innate immune system called serum amyloid P component. Now, this molecule also is a donut-shaped molecule. It's quite a lot larger than the E. coli toxin. It's about 3 or 4 times larger molecular weight, but it has the same general radial symmetry to it. And this molecule is responsible for removing cell debris from cells. And our current approach is to see if we can complex the PK trisaccharide to E. coli toxin, and on the other side of our starfish molecule, place a small molecular weight structure that is recognized by serum amyloid P component. I'll probably refer to this as SAP as we talk. Now, if that were able to happen, we could use SAP as a sort of a vacuum cleaner to take E. coli out of circulation by using 2 different recognition elements in our starfish molecule. So that's one application that we could use, and that's something that we're working on quite intensely at the moment because it's quite a hot area. Another interesting application is that serum amyloid P component is found associated with the insoluble proteins that occur in the plaques of Alzheimer's disease. So if one could remove SAP from these precipitates, these insoluble plaques, then we might be able to imagine that the insoluble protein could slowly begin to refold and the plaques dissolve. Now, this would require that we constantly remove the serum amyloid P molecule. Now, the way that this is proposed, there was a paper 2 years after our starfish publication, and both of these papers were published in Nature. This showed that the authors had made a molecule that was rather like a dumbbell. 5 copies of this dumbbell were sandwiched between 2 SAP molecules in just the same way as our starfish molecule was able to sandwich together 2 E. coli toxin molecules. So we looked at this, and it looked very similar, and we imagined that we could actually generate a carbohydrate-like molecule which would be bound by SAP, and that we could make a dumbbell-type structure with these 2 carbohydrate-type structures at the end of the dumbbell. And in fact, we've done this in our center. We have crystallographer Dr. Kenning at the University of Calgary. He has helped us, and he's solved the crystal structure of our molecule with SAP. And indeed, we see that our dumbbell-like molecules create this sandwich with SAP. So at the moment, we're collaborating with a group at the University of British Columbia who are able to look at amyloid deposits in islet cells associated with diabetes. And if we can inhibit these insoluble amyloid deposits in the islet cells, this will be a good proof of principle that the approach might also work in attacking the plaques of Alzheimer's disease. So this is something we came across, if you like, by accident through the structural similarity of the proteins involved in both of these diseases.
Thank you very much, David.
Thank you.
That was Dr. David Bundle, Scientific Director of the Alberta Ingenuity Center for Carbohydrate Science. Work in carbohydrate science occurs at the molecular level, and the success of that research depends on being able to determine what the molecules are doing. While the scientists can't really see the reactions at this tiny scale, they can figure things out by how their molecular weight changes, for example. And the tool for shedding light on that is a mass spectrometer with a giant magnet. Dr. John Clausen is the man in charge of that machine, He's an associate professor of chemistry at the University of Alberta, and he's a principal investigator with the Alberta Ingenuity Centre for Carbohydrate Science. But he's actually quite new to the study of carbohydrates.
Actually, it really originated when I first came on faculty here. Dave Bundle and I began a very fruitful collaboration involving mass spectrometry studies of proteins interacting with carbohydrates. So that was really my initiation into the carbohydrate sciences. And it's been very, very successful for us, and it's something that we want to continue.
What is your area?
So we're a mass spectrometry group. We're developing mass spectrometry-based techniques to study the interactions between biological molecules. And there's really two areas of research that we're involved in. One is to look at the interactions that exist in solution, so recognition by a protein for a particular carbohydrate and so forth, so we can detect those interactions by mass spectrometry. But a more unique aspect of our program is that we're also trying to develop gas phase methods to study the intrinsic properties of biological molecules in the absence of solvent. And we're hoping that eventually, by understanding how these molecules interact in the gas phase where there is no solvent, and compare that to what's going on in solution where biological activity is relevant, that we can begin to understand the role of solvent in molecular recognition. So why things bind together in solution.
Do you have any clues at this point?
It's very early days. At this point, we don't know how things are going to progress. One interesting thing that we have been able to establish so far is that some of the interactions that are present in solution we found are preserved when we transfer these complexes, protein-carbohydrate complexes, from solution to the gas phase and remove all of the water. And so prior to our work in that area, that was still very much an open question of whether any of the solution-specific interactions would be preserved in the gas phase.
I understand that you have a new magnet downstairs. How does that fit into what you're doing?
So we're using Fourier transform mass spectrometry, and so this involves injecting gaseous ions into a superconducting magnet. That's how we do our mass analysis. We're currently using a 4.7 Tesla magnet that's quite small on international standards, but very recently, through monies provided by CFI, the province, and also the Carbohydrate Center, we've been able to purchase a 9.4 Tesla magnet. Now, that's important for us because all aspects of performance of our instrument scale with increasing magnetic field strength. So we're doubling our magnetic field strength, and that's going to have improved tremendously the performance of the instrument, and most importantly, it's going to allow us to extend the mass range. Currently, we're restricted to studying complexes of about 50, 60 kilodaltons.
What's a kilodalton?
A hydrogen atom has a mass of about one Dalton. And so 50 kilodaltons is 50,000 Daltons. I'm not sure if that's helping you. But proteins and complexes can cover quite a wide range of masses, and they can extend up into the megadalton, so millions of Daltons. And so with the current magnet, we're really restricted to look at quite small protein complexes at the moment. With the new magnet, we'll be able to go up to about 200-250 kilodaltons, and so that's going to open up a much broader range of complexes that we can investigate.
When you're actually using these instruments, then what happens in there that gives you an idea of the chemical reactions and interactions and allows you to figure out what's really going on?
To a first approximation, we can just use the mass that we're detecting. So, for example, if we're mixing a protein together with one or more carbohydrates in solution and we know the mass of the protein, well, we can look for signals that correspond to a mass of protein plus carbohydrate. And so we would know that it's not just a protein. It is actually is bound to some other molecule. Right, so there'll be an increase in mass if there's another molecule binding to the protein. So from the mass spectrum, then, it's very easy to tell if we have binding or not. We can also, in the Fourier transform mass spectrometer, it's a trapped ion method. So we actually physically trap ions in a volume inside the magnet, and we can interrogate it using a variety of different techniques. For example, we can carry out dissociation experiments, so we can break complexes apart and see what the constituents are. We can also investigate how tightly bound they were, so how much energy do we have to put in to break a complex apart. That will be related to how tightly bound it is.
Thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
That was Dr. John Clausen, an associate professor of chemistry at the University of Alberta and a principal investigator with the Alberta Ingenuity Centre for Carbohydrate Science. Tuberculosis is making a comeback in the Western world, mainly due to the increasing resistance to the antibiotics that once defeated it. But not much research has been done on the disease. That's where Dr. Todd Lowry comes in. As a principal investigator with the Alberta Ingenuity Centre for Carbohydrate Science, Todd believes carbohydrate research holds great promise for developing new drugs or even a vaccine to prevent tuberculosis.
Well, the cell wall complex is made up of basically two types of molecules, lipids, which are sort of fatty molecules, which probably most people are familiar with, and then carbohydrates, which, again, people are familiar with, but not in the sense that these carbohydrates are. These are not sort of food sources, but rather they're structural molecules that enable the organism to produce a very rigid type of protective coat around its outer surface. So basically, the cell wall serves the function of keeping things from the outside from getting in and to keeping things inside in. Basically, what we're trying to do is eventually identify molecules that interfere with the production of these carbohydrates or the biosynthesis of these compounds. The idea is that if you can make a molecule that doesn't allow the carbohydrate coat to be produced, that the bacteria will be then more susceptible to, say, the immune system of the human host, or be more susceptible to other antibiotics, and therefore will die. And so this idea of targeting a cell wall is actually not novel. The drug penicillin actually has been used widely, and it actually targets cell wall biosynthesis in a number of different microorganisms. And we're basically trying to apply the same approach to the TB problem.
Where are you at now? How far along have you come?
Well, we're still in the early stages of this. I'd say that we've made a few compounds that seem to have some good activity in vitro, at least. And actually, in one case, a compound that was actually taken into mice, and unfortunately there was shown to be too toxic to be useful. But this was all done in my previous institution at Ohio State, or in collaboration with people at the NIH and the National Institutes of Health in D.C. So we're still in the early stages of this. A lot of our focus to date has been on trying to synthesize molecules that could be used to study how these biochemical pathways proceed and use that information then to design molecules that could be used as inhibitors of these enzymes or potential drugs.
What is it that's curious about it that we really don't know that much about it at this point?
Well, it's actually sort of a political issue, I would guess, in that for many years we thought, at least in the Western world, that we had tuberculosis or other types of mycobacterial diseases beat because there were effective antibiotics for treating these diseases. However, if you look sort of globally, there is has been a real sort of health problem with this disease, really forever. There's about a third of the world's population is infected with Mycobacterium tuberculosis, and it causes about 3 million deaths a year. The vast majority of these are in largely the third world countries, and so typically in North America or Western Europe or other industrialized centers, we just haven't worried much about these. So there's that issue that basically granting agencies weren't that interested in the problem because it wasn't viewed as a serious, at least not a serious immediate health threat. Although it's been sort of, as I mentioned, a health threat worldwide for basically forever. The thing that sort of prompted people's interest more recently is the fact that there are now drug-resistant strains of this organism that have been developed, that have emerged. And moreover, people who have suppressed immune systems, people who, for example, are HIV positive, are particularly susceptible to these diseases. And as the growing numbers of those populations increase, or as there's a more of a drug resistance problem, then it becomes more of a health threat locally in say, North America or other parts of the sort of first world. So there's that aspect of it. The other problem is that actually this organism is a very very difficult organism to culture, and it's very contagious, and so it requires very sophisticated growing conditions and lots of protection, obviously. And so, again, that's an expensive, sort of very slow and tedious process, and it just hasn't attracted a lot of people. Now that there's a sort of this realization that this is a disease that we all need to be worried about, this has prompted a lot more interest in trying to fund research into the organism and ways to kill it.
What's the challenge or the obstacle for you right now in your research?
Identifying active compounds, I would guess. I mean, the approach we're taking has been basically to there are molecules that put together the cell wall structure, and these are called enzymes. The approach that we've been taking is to try to develop methods for studying and getting these enzymes pure, and then trying to look at compounds that block their action. Okay, so an enzyme carries out a chemical reaction. We'd like to design a molecule then that would block that enzyme or block that chemical reaction from occurring. So the problem so far really has been largely in trying to get active, trying to isolate these enzymes. They've proven to be quite tricky to get to and very unstable. There are a number of other aspects of this as well, and that the molecules that the enzyme uses to carry out these chemical reactions tend to be also quite unstable and quite hard to access. And so it's been quite a challenging problem.
What's on your plate then for the next little while?
Well, we're going to continue to try to access these enzymes. We're doing a lot of synthetic chemistry. We're synthesizing molecules that could be used for treating these diseases and inhibitors of these enzymes. We're also starting to move into the vaccine area, trying to identify some of these structures have the potential to be serve as vaccine candidates for tuberculosis. And so we're sort of starting to move in that direction also within the context of the center. So I said most of our focus is probably going to be in the next year or two on trying to access these enzymes and start to identify real inhibitors. We're continuing our collaboration with this group of the NIH in the U.S. to try to identify compounds that actually have a lethal effect on the bacteria. And then we're also trying to move into the vaccine area, trying to develop vaccines for tuberculosis. And there is a vaccine that's available, but it's not all that effective, and so there's a lot of interest now in trying to identify new TB vaccines.
If drug resistance is a major problem right now, with the work that you're doing using the carbohydrate science, would that overcome the drug resistance altogether?
No, I mean, that's unfortunately, bugs are a whole lot smarter than we are in many, many ways, and that they can evolve. And so as long as you have antibiotics or drugs, bacteria will figure out ways to become resistant to them. And so unfortunately it's a bit like bucketing water out of a leaky ship. You basically just have to try to stay one step ahead of things. And that's where, you know, a vaccine would be useful, because that would then actually prevent infections from occurring.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
That was Dr. Todd Lowry, an associate professor of chemistry at the University of Alberta and also a principal investigator with the Alberta Ingenuity Center for Carbohydrate Science. That brings Innovation Alberta to a close for this week. The interviews you heard during this program are posted as audio files and as written transcripts on our website at innovationalberta.com. And you can keep up to date on technology and research events by subscribing to our weekly newsletter, Innovation Alberta Online. Innovation Alberta is sponsored by Alberta Ingenuity, Alberta Research Council, the Sustainable Forest Management Network, the Alberta Conservation Association, Ducks Unlimited Canada, the University of Lethbridge, Science Alberta Foundation, ICOR, the Informatics Circle of Research Excellence, Alberta Pacific Forest Industries, and Japan Canada Oil Sands Limited. Innovation Alberta is mixed at Riverdale Recorders and is a Porcupine Stone production. I'm Cheryl Croucher.